looking at stocks objectively. Many pick favorites and cross their fingers. Instead of relying on hope and their own opinions, successful investors pay attention to the market, which is usually right. How many of these describe your own past investment beliefs and practices? Poor principles and methods yield poor results. Sound principles and methods yield sound results. After all of this, don't feel discouraged. Just remember what Rockne would say: build up your weaknesses until they become your strong points. It takes time and a little effort to get it right, but in the end, it's worth every minute. Chapter 9. When to sell and cut your losses. Now that you've learned how and when to buy nothing but the best stocks, it's time to learn how and when to sell them. You've probably heard the sports cliché, the best offense is a strong defense. The funny thing about clichés is they are usually true. A team that's all offense and no defense seldom wins the game. In fact, a strong defense can often propel a team to great heights. During the glory days of president and general manager Branch Rickey, the Brooklyn Dodgers typically had good pitching. In the game of baseball, the combination of pitching and fielding represents the defensive side of a team and probably 70% of the game. It's almost impossible to win without them. The same holds true in the stock market. Unless you have a strong defense to protect yourself against large losses, you absolutely can't win big in the game of investing. Bernard Baruch, a famous market operator on Wall Street and trusted advisor to U.S. presidents, said it best. If a speculator is correct half of the time, he is hitting a good average. Even being right 3 or 4 times out of 10 should yield a person a fortune if he has the sense to cut his losses quickly on the ventures where he has been wrong. As you can see, even the most successful investors make mistakes. These poor decisions will lead to losses, some of which can become quite awful if you're not disciplined and careful. No matter how smart you are, how high your IQ or education, how good your information, or how sound your analysis, you're simply just not going to be right all the time. In fact, you'll probably be right less than half the time. You positively must understand and accept that rule number one for the highly successful individual investor is: always cut short and limit every loss. To do this takes discipline and courage. Baruch's point was driven home to me with an account I managed back in 1962. The general market had taken a 29% nosedive, and we were right on only one of every 3 commitments we had made in this account. Yet the account was ahead at the end of the year. The reason was that the average profit on the 33% correct decisions was more than twice the average of small losses we took when we were off target. The whole secret to winning big in the stock market is not to be right all the time, but to lose the least amount possible when you're wrong. You've got to recognize when you may be wrong and sell without hesitation to cut short every one of your losses. How can you tell when you may be wrong? That's easy. The price of the stock will drop below the price you paid for it. Each point your favorite brainchild falls below your cost increases both the chance you're wrong as well as the price you're going to pay for being wrong. When you say, "I can't sell my stock because I don't want to take a loss," you assume that what you want has some bearing on the situation. But the stock doesn't know who you are, and it couldn't care less what you hope or want. Besides, selling doesn't give you the loss. You already have the loss. If you think a loss isn't incurred until you sell the stock, you're kidding yourself. The larger the paper loss, the more real it will become. For example, if you paid $40 per share for 100 shares of Can't Miss Chemical, and it's now worth $28 per share, you have $2,800 worth of stock that cost you $4,000. You have a $1,200 loss. Whether you convert the stock to cash or hold it, it's still worth only $2,800. Even though you didn't sell, you took your loss as the stock dropped in price. You'd be better off selling and going back to a cash position where you can think far more objectively. When you're holding on to a big loss, you are rarely able to think straight. You rationalize and say it can't go any lower. However, keep in mind that there are many other stocks to choose from where your chance of recouping your loss could be greater. Here's another suggestion that may help you decide whether to sell. Pretend you don't own the stock and you have $2,800 in the bank. Then ask yourself, do I really want to buy this stock now? If your answer is no, then why are you holding on to it? Individual investors should definitely set firm rules, limiting the loss on initial invested capital in each stock to an absolute maximum of 7% or 8%. Because of large position size problems and broad diversification that lessens overall risk, most institutional investors do not have the flexibility to follow such a quick loss-cutting plan. It is very difficult for institutions to move quickly in and out of stocks, which is necessary in order for them to follow this loss-cutting rule. This is a terrific advantage you, the individual investor, have over the institutions, so use it. When the late Gerald M. Loeb of E.F. Hutton was writing his last book on the stock market, I had the pleasure of discussing this idea with him. In his first work, The Battle for Investment Survival, Loeb advocated cutting all losses at 10%. I was curious and asked him if he always followed the 10% loss policy himself. I would hope, he replied, to be out long before they ever reach 10%. Loeb made millions in the market. Bill Astrop, president of Astrop Advisory Corporation in Atlanta, Georgia, suggests a minor revision of the 10% loss-cutting plan. He thinks individual investors should sell half of their position in a stock if it is down 5% from their cost, and the other half once it's down 10%. This is sound advice. To preserve your hard-earned money, I think a 7% or 8% loss should be the limit. The average of all your losses should be less, perhaps 5% or 6%, if you're strictly disciplined and fast on your feet. If you can keep the average of all your mistakes and losses to 5% or 6%, you'll be like the football team that opponents can never move the ball on. If you don't give up many first downs, how can they ever beat you? Now here's a giant secret. If you use charts to time your buys precisely at correct buy or pivot points, coming off of sound chart bases, price consolidation areas, your stocks will rarely ever drop 8% from a correct buy point. This is a big key for your future success. Also, there's no rule that says you have to wait until every single loss reaches 7% to 8% before you take it. On occasion, you will sense that the general market index is under distribution, selling, or that your stock isn't acting right, and that you are starting off amiss. In such cases, you can cut your losses sooner, when a stock may be down only 1 or 2 points. Before the market broke wide open, in October 1987, for example, there was ample time to sell and cut losses short. That correction actually began on August 26th. If you are foolish enough to try bucking the market by buying stocks during a bear market, I would move up your absolute loss-cutting point to 3% or 4%. After years of experience, your average losses should become less as your stock selection and timing improve, and you learn to make small follow-up buys in your best stocks. It takes a lot of time to learn to safely make follow-up buys when a stock is up, but this method of money management forces you to move your money from slower-performing stocks into your stronger ones. You'll end up selling stocks that are not yet down 7% or 8% because you are raising money to add to your best winners during clearly strong bull markets. Remember, 7% to 8% is your absolute loss limit. You must sell without hesitation. No waiting a few days to see what might happen or hoping the stock rallies back. No need to wait for the day's market close. Nothing but the fact you're down 7% or 8% should have a bearing on the situation at this point. Once you're ahead and have a good profit, you can afford to give the stock a good bit more than 7% or 8% room for normal fluctuations in price. Do not sell a stock just because it's off 7% to 8% from its peak price. It's important that you understand the difference. In one case, you are probably starting off wrong. The stock is not acting the way you expected, and you are beginning to lose your own hard-earned money, and may be about to lose a lot more. In the other case, you have begun right. The stock has acted better, and you have a gain. You are working on a profit, so you can afford to give the stock more room to fluctuate, and avoid getting shaken out on a normal 10% to 15% correction. The key is timing your stock purchases exactly at breakout points to minimize the chance that a stock will drop 8%. All common stocks are speculative and risky. There is considerable risk in all common stocks, regardless of their name, quality, purported blue-chip status, previous performance record, or current good earnings. Keep in mind that most growth stocks top when their earnings are excellent and analysts' estimates are still rosy. Every 50% loss began as a 10% or 20% loss. Having the raw courage to sell and cheerfully take your loss is the only way you can protect yourself against the possibility of much greater losses. Decision and action should be instantaneous and simultaneous. To be a big winner, you have to learn to make decisions. I've known at least a dozen educated and otherwise intelligent people who were completely wiped out solely because they would not sell and cut a loss. What should you do if a stock gets away from you and the loss becomes greater than 10%, which can happen to anyone? This is an even more critical sign that the stock positively must be sold. The stock was in more trouble than normal, so it fell further and faster than normal. Many new investors in the year 2000 lost heavily, and some were wiped out, lost it all. If they had just followed the simple sell rule discussed above, they would have protected most of their capital. In my experience, those that get away from you for larger-than-normal losses are the truly awful selections that absolutely must be sold. Something is really going wrong with the stock or the whole market, and it's even more urgent that this stock be sold to avoid a later catastrophe. Remind yourself, if I ever let a stock drop 50%, I must make 100% gain on the next stock just to break even. And how often do I buy stocks that double? You cannot afford to sit with a stock where the loss keeps getting worse. It is a dangerous fallacy to assume that because a stock goes down, it has to come back up. Many don't. Others take years to recover. AT&T hit a high of $75 in 1964 and took 20 years to come back. Also, when the S&P 500 or Dow declines 20% to 25% in a bear market, many stocks will plummet 60% to 75%. The only way to prevent these types of bad losses is to cut them without hesitation while they're still small. Always protect your account so you can live to invest successfully another day. In 2000, many new investors incorrectly believed all you had to do was buy high-tech stocks on every dip in price because they would always go back up and there was easy money to be made. This is the amateur's strategy, and it almost always leads to heavy losses. You must remember, semiconductors and other technology stocks are 2 to 3 times as volatile and risky as others. So moving rapidly to cut short every loss is even more essential when you're in tech stocks. If your entire portfolio is in nothing but high-tech stocks, or if you're heavily margined in tech stocks, you are asking for serious trouble if you don't quickly cut your losses. You should never invest on margin unless you're willing to cut short all of your losses. You could go belly up in no time. If you happen to get a margin call from your broker when you're faced with a decision to either sell stock or add money to your account to cover lost equity in a falling stock, don't put good money after bad. Sell some stock and recognize what the market and your margin clerk are trying to tell you. There's an old investment saying that the first loss in the market is the smallest loss. In my view, the way to make investment decisions is to always, no exceptions, take your losses quickly and your profits slowly. Yet most investors get emotionally confused and take their profits quickly and their losses slowly. What is your real risk in any stock you buy under the method we've discussed? It's 8%, no matter what you buy, if you religiously follow this rule. Still, most investors stubbornly ask, shouldn't we sit with stocks rather than selling and taking a loss? How about unusual situations where some bad news suddenly hits and causes price declines? Does this loss-cutting procedure apply all the time, or are there exceptions, like when a company has a good new product? The answer? There are no exceptions. It doesn't change the situation one bit. You must always protect your hard-earned pool of capital. Letting your losses run is the most serious mistake made by almost all investors. You must accept the fact that mistakes in stock selection and timing are going to be made frequently, even by the most experienced of professional investors. I'd go so far as to say that if you aren't willing to cut short and limit your losses, you probably shouldn't buy stocks. Would you drive your car down the street without brakes? If you were a fighter pilot, would you go into battle without a parachute? One of the most unprofessional things a stockbroker can do is hesitate or fail to call customers whose stocks are down in price. That's when the customer needs help the most. Shirking this duty in difficult periods shows a lack of courage under pressure. About the only thing that's worse is for brokers to take themselves off the hook by advising customers to average down, buy more of a stock that already shows a loss. If I were advised to do this, I'd close my account and look for a smarter broker. Everyone loves to buy stocks. No one loves to sell them. As long as you hold a stock, you still have hope it might come back up enough to at least get you out even. Once you sell, you abandon all hope and accept the cold reality of temporary defeat. Investors are always hoping rather than being realistic. The fact that you want a stock to go up so you can at least get out even has nothing to do with the action and brutal reality of the market. The market obeys only the law of supply and demand. A great trader once noted that there are only two emotions in the market, hope and fear. The only problem, he added, is we hope when we should fear, and we fear when we should hope. Many years ago, I heard a story by Fred C. Kelly, the author of Why You Win or Lose, which illustrates perfectly how the conventional investor thinks when the time comes to make a selling decision. A little boy was walking down the road when he came upon an old man trying to catch wild turkeys. The man had a turkey trap, a crude device consisting of a big box with the door hinged at the top. The door was kept open by a prop, to which was tied a piece of twine leading back 100 feet or more to the operator. A thin trail of corn scattered along a path lured turkeys to the box. Once inside, the turkeys found an even more plentiful supply of corn. When enough turkeys had wandered inside the box, the old man would jerk away the prop and let the door fall shut. Having once shut the door, he couldn't open it again without going up to the box, and this would scare away any turkeys lurking outside. The time to pull away the prop was when as many turkeys were inside as one could reasonably expect. One day, he had 12 turkeys in his box. Then one sauntered out, leaving 11. "Gosh, I wish I had pulled the string when all 12 were there," said the old man. "I'll wait a minute, and maybe the other one will go back." While he waited for the 12th turkey to return, 2 more walked out on him. "I should have been satisfied with 11," the trapper said. "Just as soon as I get one more back, I'll pull the string." 3 more walked out, and still the man waited. Having once had 12 turkeys, he disliked going home with less than 8. He couldn't give up the idea that some of the original turkeys would return. When finally only 1 turkey was left in the trap, he said, "I'll wait until he walks out or another goes in, and then I'll quit." The solitary turkey went to join the others, and the man returned empty-handed. The psychology of the normal investor is not much different. They hope more turkeys will return to the box when they should fear that all will walk out and they'll be left with nothing. If you're a typical investor, you probably keep records of your transactions. When you think about selling a stock, you probably look at your records to see what price you paid for it. If you have a profit, you may sell. But if you have a loss, you tend to wait. After all, you didn't invest in the market to lose money. However, what you should be doing is selling your worst-performing stock first. Keep your flower patch free of weeds. You may decide to sell your shares in Home Depot, for example, because they show a nice profit. But you'll keep your Kmart, because it still has a ways to go before it's back to the price you paid. If this is the way you think, you're suffering from the price-paid bias that afflicts 95% of all investors. Suppose you bought a stock 2 years ago at $30, and it's now worth $34. Most investors would sell it because they have a profit. But what does the price paid 2 years ago have to do with its worth now? What does that have to do with whether the stock should be held or sold? The key is the relative performance of this stock versus others you either own or could potentially own. To help avoid the price paid bias, particularly if you are a longer-term investor, I suggest you use a different method of analyzing results. At the end of each month or quarter, compute the percentage change in price of each stock from the last date you did this type of analysis. Now, list your investments in order of their relative price performance since your previous evaluation period. Let's say your Caterpillar is down 6%, your ExxonMobil is unchanged, and General Electric is up 10%. Your list would start with GE on top, then ExxonMobil, then Caterpillar. At the end of the next month or quarter, do the same thing. After a few reviews, you will easily recognize the stocks that are not doing well. They'll be at the bottom of the list. Those that did best will be at or near the top. This method isn't foolproof, but it does force you to focus your attention not on what you paid for stocks, but on the relative performance of your investments in the market. It will help you maintain a clearer perspective. Of course, you have to keep records of your costs for tax reasons, but you should use this more realistic method in the longer-term management of your portfolio. Doing this more often than once a quarter can only help you. Eliminating the price-paid bias can be profitable and rewarding. Anytime a commitment in a security is made, you should also determine the potential profit and the possible loss. This is only logical. You wouldn't buy a stock if there were a potential profit of 20% and a potential loss of 80%, would you? But how do you know this is not the situation when you buy a stock if you do not attempt to define these factors and operate according to well-thought-out selling rules? Do you have specific selling rules you've written down and follow? Or are you flying blindly? I suggest you write down the price at which you expect to sell if you have a loss, 8% or less below your purchase price, as well as the expected profit potential of all the securities you purchase. For instance, you might consider selling your growth stock when its P/E ratio increases 130% or more from the time the stock originally began its big move out of its initial base pattern. By writing it down, it will be easier to see when the stock has reached one of these levels. It's bad business to base your sell decisions on your cost and hold stocks that are down in price simply because you can't accept the fact that you made an imprudent selection and lost money. In fact, you're making the exact opposite decisions from those you would make if you were running your own business. It's also risky, and possibly foolish, to say to yourself, "I'm not worried about my stocks being down because they are good stocks and I'm still getting my dividends." Good stocks bought at the wrong time can go down as much as poor stocks, and it's possible they might not be such good stocks in the first place. It may just be your personal opinion that they're good. Furthermore, if a stock is down 35% in value, isn't it rather absurd to say you're all right because you are getting a 4% dividend yield? A 35% loss plus a 4% income gain equals a whopping 31% net loss. To be a successful investor, you must face facts and stop rationalizing and hoping. No one emotionally wants to take losses, but to increase your chances of success in the stock market, you have to do many things you don't want to do, develop precise rules and hard-nosed selling disciplines, and you'll gain a major advantage. Chapter 10. When to sell and take your profit. This is one of the most vital chapters in this book, covering an essential subject few investors handle well, so study it carefully. Common stock is just like any merchandise. You, as the merchant, must sell your stock if you're to realize a profit, and the best way to sell a stock is when it's on the way up, while it's still advancing and looking strong to everyone else. This way, you won't get caught in the heart-rending 20% to 40% corrections that can hit market leaders and put downside pressure on your portfolio. You'll never sell at the exact top, so don't kick yourself if a stock goes still higher after you sell. If you don't sell early, you'll be late. The object is to make and take significant gains, and not get excited, optimistic, or greedy as a stock's advance gets stronger. Keep in mind the old saying, bulls make money and bears make money, but pigs get slaughtered. The basic objective of every account should be to show a net profit. To retain worthwhile profits, you must sell and take them. The key is knowing when to do just that. Bernard Baruch, the financier who built a fortune in the stock market, said, "Repeatedly I have sold a stock while it was still rising, and that has been one reason why I have held on to my fortune. Many a time I might have made a good deal more by holding a stock, but I would also have been caught in the fall when the price of the stock collapsed." When asked if there was a technique for making money on the stock exchange, Nathan Rothschild, the highly successful international banker, said, "There certainly is. I never buy at the bottom, and I always sell too soon." "Only a fool holds out for the top dollar," said Joe Kennedy, one-time Wall Street speculator and the father of former President John F. Kennedy. "The object is to get out while a stock is up, before it has a chance to break and turn down." Gerald M. Loeb, also, states, "Once the price has risen into estimated normal or overvaluation areas, the amount held should be reduced steadily as quotations advance." One simply must get out while the getting is good. The secret is to hop off the elevator on one of the floors on the way up, and not ride it back down again. To be a big success in the stock market, you need rules and a profit and loss plan. I developed many of the buy and sell rules described in this book in the early 1960s when I was a young stockbroker with Hayden Stone. These rules helped me buy a seat on the New York Stock Exchange and start my own firm shortly thereafter. When I started out, though, I concentrated on developing a set of buy rules that would locate the very best stocks. But as you'll see, I only had half of the puzzle figured out. My buy rules were first developed in January 1960, when I analyzed the three best-performing mutual funds of the prior 2 years. The standout was the then-small Dreyfus Fund, which racked up gains twice as large as many of its competitors. I sent away for copies of every Dreyfus quarterly report and prospectus from 1957 to 1959. Then I calculated the average cost of each new stock they purchased. Next, I got a book of stock charts and marked in red the average price that Dreyfus had paid for its new holdings each quarter. After looking at more than 100 Dreyfus purchases, I made a stunning discovery. Every stock was bought at the highest price that it had sold for in the past year. In other words, if a stock bounced from $40 to $50 for many months, Dreyfus bought as soon as it made a new high in price and traded between $50 and $51. The stocks had also formed certain chart price patterns before leaping into new high ground. This gave me two important clues. Buying on new highs was important, and certain chart patterns spelled big profit potential. Before we examine the key selling rules one by one, keep these two key points in mind. First, buying right solves most of your selling problems. If you buy exactly at the right time off a proper daily or weekly chart base in the first place, and you do not chase or pyramid a stock when it's extended in price more than 5% past a correct pivot buy point, you will be in position to sit through most normal corrections. Winning stocks very rarely ever drop 8% below a correct pivot buy point. In fact, Most big winners don't close below their pivot point. Buying as close as possible to the pivot point is therefore absolutely essential and may let you cut the smaller number of resulting losses quicker than 8%. A stock might only have to drop 4% or 5% before you know something could be wrong. Second, beware of the big block selling you see on the ticker tape just after you buy a stock during a bull market. The selling might be emotional, uninformed, temporary, or not as large, relative to past volume, as it appears. The best stocks can have sharp sell-offs for a few days or a week. Consult a stock chart for overall perspective to avoid getting scared or shaken out in what may just be a normal pullback. By studying how the greatest stock market winners all topped, as well as the market itself, I came up with the following list of factors that occur when a stock tops and rolls over. Perhaps you notice that few selling rules involve changes in the fundamentals of a stock. Many big investors get out of a stock before trouble appears on the income statement. If the smart money is selling, so should you. Individual investors don't stand much chance when institutions begin liquidating large positions. You buy with heavy emphasis on fundamentals, such as earnings, sales, profit margins, return on equity, and new products. But many stocks peak when earnings are up 100%, and analysts are projecting continued growth and higher price targets. Therefore, you must frequently sell based on unusual market action, price and volume movement. There are many different signals to look for when trying to recognize when a stock is topping. These include the price movement surrounding climax tops, adverse volume, and other weak action. A lot of this will become clearer to you as you continue to study this information, as well as apply it to your daily decision-making. These principles have been responsible for most of my success in the market, but they can seem a bit complicated at first. Climax tops. Many leading stocks top in explosive fashion. They make climax runs, when a stock suddenly advances at a much faster rate for 1 or 2 weeks after an advance of many months. In addition, they often end in exhaustion gaps, when a stock's price opens up on a gap from the prior day's close, on heavy volume. These and related bull market climax signals are discussed in detail below. 1. Largest daily price run-up. If a stock's price is extended for many months, it's had a significant run-up from its buy point off of a sound and proper base, and closes for the day with a larger price increase than on any previous up days since the beginning of the whole move up, watch out. This usually occurs very close to a stock's peak or top. 2. Heaviest daily volume. The ultimate top might occur on the heaviest volume day since the beginning of the advance. 3. Exhaustion gap. If a stock that has been advancing rapidly is greatly extended from its original base many months ago, and then opens on a gap up in price from the previous day's close, the advance is near its peak. For example, a 2-point gap in a stock's price would occur if it closed at its high of $50 for the day, and the next morning opened at $52 and held above $52 during the day. This is called an exhaustion gap. 4. Climax top activity. Sell if a stock's advance gets so active that it has a rapid price run-up for 2 or 3 weeks on a weekly chart, 8 to 10 days on a daily chart. This is called a climax top. The price spread from the stock's low to high for the week will be greater than on any prior week since the beginning of the original move, many months ago. In a few cases, near the top of a climax run, a stock may retrace the prior week's large price spread from the prior week's low to its high point, and close the week up a little, with volume remaining very high. I call this railroad tracks, because on a weekly chart, you'll see two parallel vertical lines. This is a sign of continued heavy volume distribution, without real additional price progress for the week. 5. Signs of distribution. After a long advance, heavy daily volume without further upside price progress signals distribution Sell your stock before unsuspecting buyers are overwhelmed. 6. Stock splits. Sell if a stock runs up 25% to 50% for 1 or 2 weeks on a stock split. Stocks tend to top around excessive stock splits. If a stock's price is extended from its base and a stock split is announced, in many cases, the stock could be sold. 7. Increase in consecutive down days. The number of consecutive down days in price versus up days in price will probably change and increase after most stocks start down from their top. You may see 4 or 5 days down, followed by 2 or 3 days up, whereas before you would have seen 4 days up and then 2 or 3 down. 8. Upper channel line. In a few cases, you should sell if a stock hits its upper channel line after a huge run-up. On a stock chart, channel lines are somewhat parallel lines drawn by connecting the lows of the price pattern with one straight line and then connecting the highs made over several months with another straight line. Studies show that stocks surging above their upper channel lines should be sold. 9. 200-day moving average line. Some stocks may be sold when they are 70% to 100% or more above their 200-day moving average price line. 10. Selling on the way down from the top. If you didn't sell early while the stock was still advancing, sell on the way down from the peak. After the first breakdown, some stocks may pull back up in price one time. Low volume and other weak action. 1. New highs on low volume. Some stocks will make new highs on lower or poor volume. As the stock goes higher, volume trends lower, suggesting that big investors have lost their appetite for the stock. 2. Close at or near day's price low. Tops can also be seen on a stock's daily chart in the form of arrows pointing down. That is, the stock will, for several days, close at or near the lows of the daily price ranges, fully retracing the day's advances. 3. Third or fourth stage bases. Sell when your stock makes a new high in price if it's off a third or fourth stage base. The third time is seldom a charm in the market. It has become too obvious, and almost everyone sees it. These late-stage base patterns will usually be faulty, appearing more wide and loose. 4. Signs of a poor rally. When you see initial heavy selling near the top, the next recovery will follow through weaker in volume, show poor price recovery, or last a shorter number of days. Sell on the second or third day of a poor rally. It may be the last good chance to sell before trend lines and support areas are broken. 5. Decline from the peak. After a stock declines 8% or so from its peak, in some cases, examination of the previous run-up, the top, and the decline may help determine if the advance may be over or if a normal 8% to 12% correction is in progress. You may occasionally want to sell if a decline from the peak exceeds 12% or 15%. 6. Poor relative strength. Poor relative price strength can be a reason for selling. Consider selling when a stock's IBD's relative price strength rating drops below 70. 7. Lone Ranger. Consider selling if there is no confirming price strength by any other important member of the same industry group. Breaking support. Breaking support occurs when stocks close the week below established major trend lines, as well as other forms of price support. 1. Long-term uptrend line is broken. Sell if a stock closes at the end of the week below a major long-term uptrend line or breaks a key price support area on overwhelming volume. An uptrend line should connect at least 3 intraday or intra-week price lows, occurring over a number of months. Trend lines drawn over too short of a time period aren't valid. 2. Greatest one-day price drop. If a stock already has made an extended advance and suddenly makes its greatest one-day price drop since the beginning of the move, consider selling if confirmed by other signals. 3. Falling price-heavy weekly volume. In some cases, sell if a stock breaks down on the largest weekly volume in its prior several years. 4. 200-day moving average line turns down. After a prolonged upswing, if a stock's 200-day moving average price line turns down, consider selling the stock. Also, sell on new highs if a stock has a weak base with much of the price work in the lower half of the base or below its 200-day moving average price line. 5. Living below 10-week moving average. Consider selling if a stock has had a long advance, then closes below its 10-week moving average, and lives for many weeks below that average, unable to rally. Other prime selling pointers. 1. If you cut all losses at 7% or 8%, take a few profits when up 25% or 30%. Compounding 3 gains like this could give you 100% or more gain. However, don't sell for 25% or 30% gains any market leader with institutional support that's up 20% in only 1, 2, or 3 weeks from the pivot buy points on a proper base. Those could be your big leaders and should be held for a potentially greater profit. 2. Big investors must sell when they have buyers to absorb their stock. Therefore, consider selling if a stock runs up and then good news or major publicity, a cover article in Business Week, for example, is released. 3. When it's exciting and obvious to everyone that a stock is going higher, sell because it's too late. Jack Dreyfus said, "Sell when there is an overabundance of optimism, when everyone is bubbling over with optimism and running around trying to get everyone else to buy. They are fully invested. At this point, all they can do is talk. They can't push the market up anymore. It takes buying power to do that. Buy when you're scared to death and others are unsure. Wait until you are happy and tickled to death to sell." 4. In most cases, sell when quarterly earnings percentage increases slow materially for 2 consecutive quarters. 5. Be careful of selling on bad news or rumors. They may be of temporary influence. Rumors are sometimes started to scare the individual investor, the little fish, out of his or her holdings. 6. Always learn from all of your past selling mistakes. Do your own post-analysis by plotting on charts your past buy and sell points. Study your mistakes carefully and write down additional rules to avoid past mistakes that caused excessive losses. Closely related to the decision on when to sell is when to sit tight. Following are some suggestions for doing just that. Buy growth stocks where you can project a potential price target based on earnings estimates for the next year or two and possible PE expansion from the stock's original base breakout. Your objective is to buy the best stock with the best earnings at exactly the right time and have the patience to hold it until you have been proven right or wrong. In a few cases, you may have to allow 13 weeks after your first purchase before you conclude that a stock that hasn't moved is a dull, faulty selection. This, of course, applies only if the stock did not reach your defensive, loss-cutting sell price first. In a fast-paced market, like the one in 1999, tech stocks that didn't move after several weeks while the general market was moving higher could have been sold earlier, and the money moved into other stocks that were breaking out of sound bases with top fundamentals. When your hard-earned money is on the line, it's important more than ever to pay attention to the general market and check IBD's The Big Picture column, which analyzes the market averages. If you make new purchases when the market averages are under distribution, topping, and starting to reverse direction, you'll have trouble holding the stocks you've bought. Most breakouts will fail, and most stocks will go down. So stay in phase with the general market direction. Don't argue with a declining market. After a new purchase, draw a defensive sell line in red on a daily or weekly graph at the precise price level at which you will sell and cut your loss, 8% or less below your buy point. In the first 1.5 to 2 years of a new bull market, you may want to give stocks this much room on the downside and hold until the price touches the sell line before selling. In some instances, the sell line may be raised, but kept below the low of the first normal correction after your initial purchase. If you raise your loss-cutting sell point, don't move it up too close to the current price. This will keep you from being shaken out during any normal weakness. You definitely shouldn't continue to follow a stock up by raising stop-loss orders, because you will be forced out near the low of an inevitable, natural correction. Once your stock is 15% or more above your purchase price, you can begin to concentrate on the price where, or under what rules, you will sell on the way up to nail down your profit. Any stock that rises close to 20% should never be allowed to drop back into the loss column. If you buy a stock at $50 and it shoots up to $60, plus 20% or more, and you don't take the profit when you have it, there's no intelligent reason to ever let it drop all the way back to $50 or below and create a loss. You may feel embarrassed, ridiculous, and not too bright buying at $50, watching it hit $60, and then selling at $50 to $51, but you've already made the mistake of not taking your profit. Avoid making a second mistake and letting it develop into a loss. Remember, one important objective is to keep all of your losses as small as possible. Also, major advances require time to complete. Don't take profits during the first 8 weeks of a move unless the stock gets into serious trouble or is having a 2 or 3 week climax run-up on a stock split. Stocks that show a 20% profit in less than 8 weeks should be held through the 8 weeks unless they are of poor quality, without institutional sponsorship or strong group action. In many cases, dramatic stocks advancing 20% or more in only 1 to 4 weeks are the most powerful stocks of all, capable of doubling, tripling, or more. If you own one of these true, can-slim market leaders, try to hold it through the first couple of times it pulls back in price, to or slightly below its 10-week moving average price line. Once you have a decent profit, try to hold through the stock's first short-term correction of 10% to 20%. Remember, your objective is not just to be right, but to make big money when you are right. "It never is your thinking that makes big money," said Livermore. "It's the sitting." Investors who can be right and sit tight are rare. It takes time for a stock to make a large gain. The first 2 years of a new bull market typically provides your best and safest period, but require courage, patience, and profitable sitting. If you really know a company and its products well, you'll have the additional confidence required to sit tight through several inevitable but normal corrections. Achieving giant profits in a stock takes time and patience. Chapter 11. Should you diversify, invest for the long haul, buy on margin, sell short, etc.? When you decide to participate in the stock market, there are more decisions you are faced with besides which stock to purchase. There's the notion of how you will handle your portfolio, how many stocks you should buy, what types of actions you will take, and what types of investments are better left alone. This chapter will introduce you to the many options and alluring diversions you have at your disposal. Some are very beneficial and worthy of your attention, while many others are overly risky, complicated, or an unnecessary distraction and less rewarding pursuit. Regardless, it helps to be informed and know as much about the investing business as possible. How many times have you been told, "Don't put all your eggs in one basket"? On the surface, it seems like good advice, but my experience is that few people do more than one or two things exceedingly well. Jacks of all trades and masters of none are rarely dramatically successful in any field, including investing. Would you go to a dentist who did a little engineering or cabinet making on the side, and who on weekends wrote music and worked as an auto mechanic, plumber, and accountant? This is true of companies as well as people. The best example of diversification in the corporate world is the conglomerate. Most conglomerates don't do well. They're too big, too inefficient, and too spread out in too many businesses to focus effectively and grow profitably. Do you remember when Mobil Oil diversified into the retail business when it bought Montgomery Ward, the struggling national department store chain? It never worked. Neither did Sears Roebuck move into financial services with the purchases of Dean Witter and Coldwell Banker, nor General Motors' takeover of computer services giant EDS, nor hundreds of other corporate diversification attempts. The more you diversify, the less you know about any one area. Many investors over-diversify. The best results are usually achieved through concentration, by putting your eggs in a few baskets you know well and watch very carefully. The more stocks you own, the slower you may be to react and take selling action to raise sufficient cash when a serious bear market begins. You should sell, get off margin, and raise at least some cash when major market tops occur. Otherwise, you will give back most of your profits. The winning investor's objective should be to have one or two big winners, rather than dozens of very small profits. It's much better to have a number of small losses and a few very big profits. Broad diversification is often a hedge for ignorance. Most people with $20,000 to $100,000 to invest should consider limiting themselves to four or five carefully chosen stocks. Once you own five stocks and a tempting situation comes along that you want to buy, you should muster the discipline to sell off your least attractive investment. If you have $5,000 to $20,000 to invest,